This is Faith and Reasoning, which is an apologetics ministry here at Reston Bible Church, and we have two purposes. One is to equip Christians to be prepared to give the reason for the hope that they have, and the second is to be able to share spiritual truth with those who are seeking it. So we hope this is a comfortable place for you to come and take everything in. The topic tonight I'm very excited about, does God exist? Scott will be making the case in the affirmative, and he'll speak first. Dennis, not a believer, will be making the case against. We'll be challenging Scott's claims. The format of the debate is going to be as follows. Each of these guys, Scott and Dennis, is going to have 15 minutes for their opening statements. Then they're going to have two rounds of rebuttals. The first round will be 10 minutes each. The second round, 5 minutes each. And then each will have 7.5 minutes for a closing statement. Please withhold your applause or comments until the very end. Huge question, and we're going to dive right in. So I'm going to turn it over to Scott, and we'll get started. Scott, you have 15 minutes.
Ten.
Clock's ticking. Good evening. It's a privilege to be here tonight, both because I get to talk about the most important subject in the world and because I actually get to do it with Dennis. Usually in a debate, it's not always the case that you like the person sitting across from you, but Dennis is a friend. And so it's good to have a debate with a friend once in a while. But we'll be enemies for a second, if that's okay with Dennis. So tonight we're here to debate a question. Does God exist? I'd love to ask those, anybody who's taking notes, that at some point you draw like a line down the middle of the paper and put arguments and evidence for God on one side and arguments and evidence for or against God on the other side. I think you'll be surprised to find two things by the end of our discussion. One is that all the scientific evidence will be on the side of the paper for God's existence. And the second is that those arguments will be constructed using deductive logic supported by our best scientific evidence, while any claims for atheism will be faith-based and instead mostly opinions instead of logical argumentation. I'd like for you to factor for logical rigor and scientific evidence when you're judging this, what you hear tonight. Now, we're not here to debate social impact of religion, Old Testament ethics, biblical inerrancy, theory of evolution, all important topics and worthy of their own debates, but that's not the subject of tonight's debate. So let me start with four arguments for the existence of God, which I will borrow at many points verbatim from Dr. William Lane Craig's public debates, as Dennis is well aware, and Dennis is a huge William Lane Craig fan. In fact, he heads up the local chapter. Just kidding. First is the cosmological argument. Now, the question of why anything exists at all, or why slides don't move. The quest of why anything exists at all is the most profound question in philosophy. The philosopher Derek Parfey says, no question is more sublime than why there is a universe, why there is anything rather than nothing. Now, historically, atheists have answered the question by saying the universe is eternal and uncaused. But there are good reasons, both philosophical and scientific, to believe that the universe did begin to exist. Now, philosophically, the idea of an infinite past seems absurd. If you just think about it, if the universe never began to exist, then that means the number of past events in the history of the universe is infinite. Not making enough noise, sorry. But mathematicians, or I'll speak up a little bit because I can't get any closer. Mathematicians recognize the existence of an actually infinite thing leads to self-contradictions. For example, what do you get when you subtract infinity minus infinity? Well, mathematically, you get self-contradictory answers, which is why in transfinite math, operations like subtraction are prohibited. You can't do them. That shows infinity is just an idea in your mind, not something that exists in reality. But that entails that since past events must be finite, since past events are not just ideas but are real, the number of past events must be finite. Therefore, the series of past events can't go on forever, and the universe must have begun to exist. Now, this conclusion has been confirmed by remarkable discoveries in astronomy and astrophysics. In one of the most startling developments of modern science, we now have pretty strong evidence that the universe is not eternal in the past, but began a finite time ago. Physicist P.C.W. Davies explains it this way. The coming into being of the universe, as discussed in modern science, is not just a matter of imposing some sort of organization on a previously incoherent state, but literally the coming into being of all physical things from nothing. The famous physicist Stephen Hawking says on his website, on the front page of it, quote, all the evidence seems to indicate that the universe has not existed forever, but that it had a beginning. Now, this is a remarkable statement. Literally, all the scientific evidence from cosmology and astrophysics is in support of the second premise. You might be further surprised to learn who else agrees with this statement, my opponent tonight. He accepts the truth of both premises of this argument, and he accepts its conclusion, but what he contested in the past is what the argument gives us. Let me outline that for you. Because time has a beginning, the cause of the universe must be timeless. Because space has a beginning, that cause must also be spaceless. Because matter and energy come into existence at the beginning of the universe, it must be immaterial. And since it called the universe into existence from absolutely nothing, it must be enormously powerful. It cannot have always been causing, so it must be capable of causing to choose. So it cannot always have been causing what's been going on. It must be capable of choosing to cause something, and so it must be personal. And because it's immaterial, there are only two classes of things that we know that exist as immaterial objects. One are abstract objects, and the other is a mind. But abstract objects do not cause things to happen. And so therefore, it is the case that the cosmological argument gives us a timeless, spaceless, immaterial, enormously powerful, personal, abstract mind. Secondly, the argument from fine-tuning. In recent decades, scientists have been stunned by the discovery that the initial conditions of the Big Bang were fine-tuned for the existence of intelligent life with a precision and a delicacy that literally defy human comprehension. This fine-tuning is of two sorts. First, when the laws of nature are expressed as mathematical equations, you'll find appearing in them certain constants, like the gravitational constant. These constants are not determined by the laws of nature. The laws of nature are consistent with a wide range of values for these constants. Secondly, in addition to these constants, there are certain arbitrary quantities that are put on as initial conditions on which the laws of nature operate. For example, the amount of entropy in the initial condition of the universe, and the balance between matter and antimatter in the universe. Now, all these constants and qualities fall into an extraordinarily narrow range of life-permitting values. Were these constants or qualities to be altered by even a hair's breadth, life as we know it would be completely destroyed. To give one example, the atomic weak force, if it was altered by as little as one part in 10 to the 100th power, and for comparison, there are 10 to the 80th protons, neutrons, and electrons in the entire universe, by as little as 1 in 100th power, would not have permitted a life-permitting universe. And this is actually not contentious. The fine-tuning of the universe is well acknowledged by modern physics, as can be seen by an endless list of eminent physicists who've written on the problem, including Dr. Sean Carroll, who recently debated Dr. Craig on the low entropy condition of the early universe, which Robin Collins calls a low entropy condition, quote, the potentially most outstanding case of fine tuning, end quote. Carroll writes, quote, if the universe we see really is all there is, with a Big Bang as a low entropy beginning, we seem to be stuck with an uncomfortable fine tuning problem, end quote. Now, are there three possible explanations for the remarkable fine-tuning? Physical necessity, chance, or design? In fact, now it can't be due to physical necessity because the constants and quantities are independent of the laws of nature. In fact, string theory predicts that there are possibly 10 to the 500th power different possible universes consistent with nature's laws. So could the fine-tuning be due to chance? Well, the problem with this alternative is that the odds against the fine-tuning occurring by accident are so incomprehensibly great that they cannot be reasonably faced. The probability that all the constants and quantities would fall by chance alone into that infinitesimally small life-permitting range is vanishingly small. We now know that life-prohibiting universes are vastly more probable than any life-permitting universe. So if the universe were the product of chance, the odds are overwhelming that it would be life-prohibiting. So how do atheists rescue the alternative chance? Stand by for the faith that I mentioned. They posit a completely unevidenced metaphysical hypothesis, namely that there exists an infinite number of randomly ordered, undetectable universes that are composing a multiverse of which our universe is but a part. Somewhere in this infinite world ensemble, finely tuned universes will appear by chance alone. And we happen to be in one such world. There's literally zero evidence for this hypothesis. We're asked to believe it based on faith alone, and that hypothesis faces a devastating objection. Namely, our universe is just a random member of an infinite world ensemble, and it's overwhelmingly more probable that we should be observing a much different universe than that which we in fact observe. Roger Penrose has calculated that it is inconceivably more probable that our solar system would suddenly form from the random collision of particles than that a finely tuned universe like this would exist. Penrose calls it utter chicken feed by comparison. So if our universe were just a random member of a world ensemble, it is inconceivably more probable that we should be observing a highly ordered region no larger than the size of our solar system. Observable universes like these are simply much more plenteous in the world ensemble. And since we do not have such observations, that fact strongly disconfirms the multiverse hypothesis. On atheism, at least, it is highly probable that there is no world ensemble. So the fine-tuning of the universe is therefore plausibly due neither to necessity or to chance. And as a result, the best explanation of the fine-tuning of the universe is design. Now, we should note that design is not apparent just to cosmologists. Famous critic of religion Richard Dawkins says, quote, "Biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose." Atheist co-discoverer of DNA and Nobel laureate Francis Crick has written, quote, "Biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see is not designed, but rather evolved." Of course, both of these men would ask us to believe that what appears designed is an illusion. Third, the moral argument. If God does not exist, then objective moral values do not exist. And by objective moral values, I mean moral values which are valid and binding, whether anybody believes in them or not. Many theists and atheists agree that if God does not exist, then moral values are not objective in this way. Michael Ruse, a noted atheistic philosopher of science, explains, quote, "The position of the modern evolutionist is that morality is a biological adaptation, no different than our hands and feet and teeth. Considered as a rationally justifiable set of claims about an objective something, ethics is illusory." Like Professor Ruse, I just don't see any reason to think that in the absence of God, the morality which has emerged among these imperfectly evolved primates called Homo sapiens is objective. And here Mr. Clark seems to agree with me. On the atheistic side, then, an action like rape is not socially advantageous, and so in the course of human development has become taboo. But that does absolutely nothing to prove that rape is really morally wrong. On the atheistic view, there's really nothing wrong with raping someone or torturing a 4-year-old girl to death for fun. But the problem is that objective values do exist, and we know it. In fact, we know the reality of right and wrong even more certainly than we know 2 plus 2 equals 4. If someone writes on a board 2 plus 2 equals 5, we know and we feel that is wrong. But if we saw someone torturing a 4-year-old girl to death, we not just know that is wrong, we feel it, even more so than 2 plus 2 equals 5 is wrong. The atheist asks us to believe that this is merely an illusion brought on by evolution, but we are asked to take that on faith, when our own direct interaction with the world tells us very strongly that such an action is really, actually wrong, from which it follows, logically and inescapably, that God exists. Finally, the argument from intentionality and free will. Now, people always love to have would always love to have direct evidence of something immaterial, something transcendent. Well, you have that right here in this room. The fact that you can think of or about something is called being in a state of intentionality. Now, it's impossible for one physical object to be about or of something else. A rock can't be about a tree, or a wet chunk of matter can't be about a computer. But since a physical object cannot be about another physical object, we obviously are thinking about other things. That this very clearly demonstrates that we do not have only a physical brain. This is about intentionality. This is the state of intentionality. And so there's another equally inexplicable phenomenon under atheism, and that's free will. On atheism, there is no basis for free will. Everything is determined at the subatomic level. And so if we think we have free will, on atheism, that is an illusion. Now, if you think that you have, that you can think about or of things, or if you believe that you have free will, if you think that you chose to come here tonight, then it entails that God exists. So in summary, we have four arguments for the existence of God, all of which are deductive, logical arguments, which means that if the premises are true, then the conclusions are true necessarily. Notice that the only evidence I've cited has been from atheistic or agnostic philosophers and scientists, and is in accordance with the modern consensus of science. So I'm using logic and science as my method to argue for God's existence tonight, and I think these four arguments make a powerful cumulative case for God's existence. Dennis will have to show where all of these arguments fail and build a case of his own against God's existence. Unless he does so, I think we're rational and scientific to follow the evidence, which says that God exists. I was with 4 seconds left. That's not terribly long. All right, you're up.
Scott, I've got this one too.
Okay.
Is this close enough?
You guys hear in the far back?
Well, Scott, you convinced me. When I first agreed to do this debate, it was with the idea that I could make atheists out of all of you. I met recently with Ruben Devia. Is that how you say your name? And he convinced me that's not going to happen, Dennis. It's just not going to happen. Scott said you should draw a line down the paper. I have no illusion that I'm even going to collect one check mark on my side of the paper. But if I could just get you to just think about some of these things, then I'll feel I'll have succeeded. I've had friends, and by the way, I want to acknowledge Ruben because he was very helpful to me in doing this. If I have any success, it's due to him. If I fail, it's due to myself. I've had friends say to me, why are you going to this Bible church and talking about this? I said, are you nuts? I said, aren't you afraid they're going to have you rolling on the floor or speaking in tongues or handling snakes? I said, well, you know, it all depends on what your background of fear is. And there's a reason for doing this. I was born in D.C. in a section that was about 1% Caucasian. I walk out of the house every day. It wasn't a question of if I was going to be in a fist fight. It was how many. I skipped the second and third grades. Somebody had the bright idea I should be in the fourth grade when I was in the first grade. Now, that was all right with the guys because I was big. I was athletic. But girls, forget about it. They were 2 years older than I was at an age where I still don't understand you people. I was raised as a strict Southern Baptist. My earliest memories are I'm going to hell. The ground in my nightmares would open up and I'd fall into flames. I didn't even know what I did, but that's what I thought was going to happen to me. My grandfather was a bootlegger in Southwest Virginia. He used to take me and my brother on his moonshining rides into Tennessee and West Virginia. They were kind of scary. Interesting things happened on those. I got into high school. I played football and basketball. I found myself in a game trying to guard Elgin Baylor. I played in a charity game where I found myself trying to guard Wes Unseld. Those are scary propositions. But the worst, and I don't think I've ever told it. No, no, I forget. I was in Denver. And found myself in jail for 10 days on a suspicion of rape, armed robbery, and assault with a deadly weapon. I didn't do it, but that was in the day when they could put you in jail for 10 days and just run you ragged. But the scariest thing that ever happened, I don't think I even shared this with you, was in 1978, I was in my house with my then wife, four kids, two dogs, a cat, a rabbit, and a ferret. And an airplane hit the house. We had about maybe a minute for me and my wife to get the four kids out of the house when it just blew up, just exploded. Now, Christians and people came out of the woodwork saying to me, it's a miracle. This is the most miraculous thing. Aren't you indebted to Jesus or God for this happening? So let me ask you, how many of you people think that was a miracle? I know you weren't there, but trust me, it was unbelievable. Do you think it was a miracle that I got out of that thing? My kids got out of it alive?
Sure.
Was it also a miracle that the four people in the plane died? That the woman across the street watching all this happen had a heart attack and died? So I'm just bringing all this up by way of showing that it all depends on what you fear. Now to get directly to I'm just going to make two arguments against the existence of God, Scott's cosmological argument and the ontological argument. Scott says that the ultimate conclusion is if the universe has a cause, then a transcendent, uncaused, personal creator of the universe exists, who without the universe is beginningless, changeless, immaterial, timeless, senseless, and enormously powerful, and a mind. Scott and William Lane Craig, his idol, argue that it is intuitive that the universe must have had a beginning because everything in the universe had a beginning and was caused by something. Now, let's grant that. Just for the sake of argument, let's grant it. Then if the creator is timeless, the creation of the universe must have been simultaneous. Cause and effect must have been simultaneous. Then the previous intuition should also apply. Well, if that's the case, then we should see evidence in the ordinary world of simultaneous creation, cause and effect happening at the same time. But we don't. Another problem with simultaneous creation is that God is atemporal and timeless before creation and temporal in time after creation. But after simultaneous creation, there is no way to determine the order of cause and effect. So if you apply the same logic, you can't eliminate the possibility or a probability that the universe created God and not the other way around. There are scientific cosmological models for the universe. Right or wrong, they are internally consistent and logical. But to ask what is the cause of the universe is really nonsensical. It's like looking at someone taking pictures with an iPhone and asking, where does the film go? It's the wrong question to ask. It doesn't make any sense. And what gives us the right to demand some kind of external cause of the universe? The idea that intuitions about cause and effect that we get from everyday experience of the world somehow be extended without modification to the fundamental nature of reality is absurd. Now, although he didn't do it tonight, Scott is very proud and very reliant on the Bohr-Guth-Vilenkin theorem. I'm going to skip that, unless you bring it up in the rebuttal. Now, the ontological argument. The premise is, if God exists, it is a maximally great being. And it goes like this. It is possible that a maximally great being exists. If it is possible that a maximally great being exists, then a maximally great being exists in some possible world. If a maximally great being exists in some possible world, then it exists in every possible world. If a maximally great being exists in every possible world, then it exists in the actual world. If a maximally great being exists in the actual world, then a maximally great being exists. Therefore, a maximally great being exists, and it is God. Now notice, you don't have to turn that very far around to get a different result. Just change the wording slightly. It is possible that a maximally great being does not exist. If it is possible that a maximally great being does not exist, then a maximally great being does not exist in some possible world. If a maximally great being does not exist in some possible world, then it does not exist in every possible world. If a maximally great being does not exist in every possible world, then it does not exist in the actual world. If a maximally great being does not exist in the actual world, then a maximally great being does not exist. Therefore, a maximally great being and God do not exist. Now, the problem with this ontological argument is that Scott and Craig believe that God is atemporal, timeless prior to creation, and in time and temporal after creation. Therefore, when time came into existence, he ceases to be a maximally great being because he has lost the property of being timeless. If you lose something, then you're not the maximally great being. It also leads to an infinity of progressive, it leads to a progressive infinity. The maximally great being is like an infinitely large number. You can't add to it. But if it's a maximally great being, then if he loses something or he adds something to it, that leads to an absurdity. If the maximally great being decides to create the universe, then he becomes a creator, whereas before he wasn't. So if you add something to him, he's no longer a maximally great being, he's something even greater. And this can go on forever. A being that can change from one state to another, from non-creator to creator, cannot transcend time and must be temporal, since any change by definition requires a prior and later state of affairs, and that demands time, which violates Craig's and Scott's premise that God is atemporal and timeless. Some attributes of greatness are incompatible with others. God is supposed to be omnipotent, omniscient, and morally perfect. Omniscience and omnipotence may be incompatible. If God is omnipotent, then he should be able to create a being with free will. But if he is omniscient, then he should know exactly what such a being will do. This renders the ontological argument incoherent, as the characteristics required of a maximally great being cannot coexist in one being. Therefore, such a being cannot exist. How much time I got?
Four minutes, 50 seconds.
Okay. I'm going to leave the rest of what I was going to do to rebuttal because Scott brought them up in his. Thank you.
Thanks, Dennis. I thought that was pretty good. He's laid out a pretty challenging interaction for me here. So let's look initially. I laid out four arguments for God's existence. Now, Dennis, that was Dennis's opening statement, so he still has a rebuttal to go. So he doesn't necessarily, he should not necessarily have had to address all of my arguments yet. But let's talk about the few couple that he did address. First, the cosmological argument. Now, Dennis has made the point that you cannot have simultaneous causation. And the reason that you can't have, that we know there's no such thing as simultaneous causation is because we don't see it happening here. But I would argue that that is, in fact, not the case. We see simultaneous causation all the time. If you put a bowling ball on a bed, and that bowling ball is sitting there, you'll see a deformation in the bed, and you'll see the bowling ball sitting in it. Now, neither one of them are moving at this point, but the cause of the deformation is presently the bowling ball. Now, it is the case that logically prior to that, and in fact, temporarily prior to that, you move the bowling ball into that position. But does that mean it's impossible for simultaneous causation to exist? Now, what we will say is we have to make a distinction between temporal causation and logical causation. Logical causation is what comes logically prior to an event. So as an example, if you think of if we think down to the atomic level of the fission of an atom, simultaneous with that breaking of the atom is a release of energy, as an example. Those two things are happening simultaneously. The breaking of the atom and the release of energy are happening. The cause of that may have been a neutron coming in. That is what's logically prior. But there's an efficient cause and a material cause. And the efficient cause is always logically prior to whatever event that we're talking about. So I don't think that there's any good reason to think that that causation cannot be simultaneous, especially, and if this is a problem for the theist, you'll note it's the identical problem for the atheist. That is to say, if the universe began to exist, and causation, and there was no time, then there is no state to change from. You have an unchanging, timeless state where nothing exists, and yet the universe pops into being uncaused with no prior causation, no efficient cause, and no material cause. So if it is difficult for the theist to explain how something can be caused simultaneously because they are positing an efficient cause, it has to be doubly difficult to bring into existence a universe without an efficient cause or a material cause, and with nothing logically prior to the causation of the universe. So I don't know that this weakens the cosmological argument. Now, I don't actually think that God was atemporal without the universe and temporal. That is Craig's position. That's not my position. However, I will defend it here, and then I'll add a little bit as to what I actually believe, which I didn't intend to bring up tonight, but a little freewheeling makes it a little fun. He says that the cause, that asking even the question, what is the cause, is absurd, and that our intuition fails. You'll remember in my opening statement I told you, at one point you were going to hear opinion, and that you were going to hear basically something asked to take, for you to ask there, you're going to be asked to take something on faith. This is taking something on faith. You have a strong intuition that things have to have causes, that things just don't pop into existence uncaused out of nothing. Yes, we never observe that things pop into existence uncaused out of nothing. Things don't pop into existence in the room here. They don't pop into existence on Saturn uncaused out of nothing. But you're to take it on faith that universes can do that. Now, there is no logical reason for that to happen. There is no possible logical explanation of that. But we're told to ignore our intuition and assume that that is an illusion. So I want the idea of illusion will come up several times during this debate, if it hasn't already, and I ask that you take note of what is asked to be called an illusion. Our own intuitions about causality are being asked to be called an illusion. Now, I didn't bring up the ontological argument tonight, and I don't because it's a difficult argument to understand. Most people who don't have any training in modal logic, it just goes right over your head. In fact, professional philosophers have difficulty dealing with this one. So I'll spend a little bit of time on it because Dennis brought it up. But ultimately, he does a good way to take down an ontological argument. He attempts an analogy that shows that this argument fails. That is actually a good technique. Now, the problem is the analogy that he uses is he does an inversion of it. He says a maximally great being does not exist. So premise one, which unfortunately we don't have for it to display for you, but is possible that a maximally great being exists. And the second premise is if it is possible a maximally great being exists, then a maximally great being exists in some possible world. The third premise is the key here to answering this argument. If a maximally great being exists in some possible world, then a maximally great being exists in every world. That third premise, which is actually the basis of what modal logic is, the logic of necessity and contingency, only works in the case of a maximally great being. And the reason is this: the definition of a maximally great being is a being that has maximal greatness in all great-making properties. And one of those great-making properties is you can be a contingent being like us. We don't have to exist. It might have been possible that we didn't exist. A maximally great being is one that is not contingent but is necessary. Now, a maximally great being not existing violates that modal premise. And this is what's difficult to understand. If you're not into modal logic, it won't make any sense to you. But if you understand modal logic, you'll actually know this. The third premise of the argument is not the contentious premise. You should be surprised to learn that premises 2 through 5 or 6, depending on how it's structured, are completely non-controversial in logic. The only one that's controversial is premise 1. It is possible that a maximally great being exists. So what this means is if you think that it's even possible that a maximally great being exists, then that it means that God does exist. And this is widely recognized in logic and philosophy. Dennis points out that a loss of an essential trait would decrease that being's maximal greatness. But remember, atemporality is not a trait. It's a description of a lack of a trait. That is a being that does not exist in time. So if there is no time, a maximally great being, of course, exists timelessly. That is to say, it doesn't require time to exist. But if time does exist, in order to be maximally great, that being would have to instantiate that time. So moving from one state to another happens in a contingent manner, and it is a counterfactual. If something happens, then a maximally great being must react in a certain way. And I'll give you an example. Is God all-loving if he lives on his own? If there was only God, and it'll say it's not a Trinitarian God, a generalized theistic God, there's only God, he can be all good, but he can't be all loving because there's no object to his love. But if he creates another object, that object that he creates, that person that he creates, he could love them. In fact, as a maximally great being, he would love them. Did he gain the trait of loving? No, he didn't, because loving is a contingent thing that happens if another being exists. So you'll note that in the same way that if there is a flask that's full of, a scientific flask that's full of liquid, if the flask gets bigger and the liquid increases in that glass, it's still maximally full the whole time. So if you populate a world with more things, more space, more things for that being to be maximally great, his maximal greatness will be directly proportionate to that same space. Additions of characteristics are making something maximally great, which was I probably should have made Dennis's point before I made the point about the beaker or the flask. And then Dennis brings up what I think is actually the best argument against God. He didn't state it explicitly, but he brought up the logical problem of evil, that it's not possible for God to exist and the evil in the world to exist. Or alternately, he says there are traits about God that cannot coexist, like can he be all-loving and can he be all-knowing? And the answer is, of course he can be all-loving and all-knowing. For God to know something in the future doesn't mean that it has to happen. What it means is that he knows whether that thing will happen or will not happen, but that is still contingent on the other being choosing it. So as an example, can God be all-loving and still create a world that has evil in it? Well, I would say this, two things. One, if he creates another person in that world, he has to give that person the option not to love him. If he doesn't, he is compelling that person to love him, which is not in the definition of love. In fact, in its worst form, we call that rape. So the other being must have free will. If the other being must have free will, it has the ability to choose or not choose free will. to obey and love that God. If it chooses not to love that God, then ultimately what you end up with is evil happening in the world. And that happens contingently based on God loving the being and creating it with free will. So it is a necessary conclusion that evil is a possibility. Now, the second thing I would say about that is this. Are we saying that evil exists? Are we saying that a being is not cannot be maximally great because evil is out there? Well, evil, remember by my moral argument, proves the existence of God. That is to say, if anything is evil, it requires a God to be there in order for it to even have existed in the first place. That there is no good or no evil if there isn't God. So if Dennis wants to say that God is evil, that evil actually proves the existence of God.
Actually, I don't want to dwell on the ontological argument because Scott's right, it is complicated. But he did put words in my mouth when he said I brought up the question of evil. I didn't mention evil. I don't think that has anything to do with whether God exists or not. I'm not even sure there is such a thing as evil. But getting to the idea of simultaneous creation, he brought up the one that theists usually bring up, and that's the bowling ball on the pillow, that nothing causes that indentation. Now, he did say that, yes, you do have to move the bowling ball from the pillow, which requires time. But he forgot to mention the fact that once it touches the pillow, you have to let it go, and it sinks into the pillow. That also requires time. So that's not an example of simultaneous causation and effect. There is still some time elapsing between placing the ball there and letting it go, and the indentation happening. Now, this popping into existence business really fascinates me. It is the wrong question to ask. Let me find the page. It is the wrong question to ask, can something pop into existence? God, I wish I had slides. Of course, nothing pops into existence out of nothing, because before there was the universe, there was nothing. There was nothing to begin with. So how can something pop into existence, or even come into existence, or even arrive from nothing? Now, this business about objective morality. I don't believe there's such a thing as objective morality. I think that the reason that we behave as we do is because we are social animals, and I'm going to use a dirty word, so put your hands over your ears. As social animals, we evolved to be social animals. And in order to survive as a species, as a social animal, we had to develop characteristics and behavior which enhances and optimizes the chances for reproduction and survival. We behave because it would be disevolutionary to misbehave. We would tend to destroy the species. Now, this is really going to blow some heads up. Is rape objectively immoral? You all would say yes. I would say no. In the early development of man, rape may have been very necessary for the continuing evolution of man. There weren't very many humans around, and men being the pigs they got to go deposit their sperm all over the place in order to create enough humans to evolve. So rape is not objectively moral now, but it was then. Things change. Is torturing a 4-year-old girl objectively immoral? It just doesn't make any sense evolutionarily, because it takes one more reproductive machine out of the species. So we don't do it, unless we're nuts. If you say that there's such a thing as objective morality, does that apply to animals? Scott, are you a vegetarian?
No.
You wear leather?
Yes, not as a rule.
But you wear it?
Yes.
Okay. Since objective morality really boils down to don't harm and do help. Does that apply to animals? Should we all be vegetarians? So where does objective morality start and stop? Fine-tuning. I love this one. If you thought that the physical parameters of our universe, remember, he said finely tuned for life. If it was finely tuned for to allow life to exist, you would expect enough tuning, but not too much. Well, look at what we got. The parts of our universe where life can live is about 0.0001% of the universe. The rest of it can't possibly survive. Why would God create a universe where we can't even think about existing in 99.999% of it? Under the notion of God, you would expect life to play a special role in the universe since it was created for us. Does our life play a special role in the universe? Life is very insignificant as far as the rest of the universe is concerned. What you should be doing over and over again is comparing the prediction or expectations under God to under naturalism, which predicts this kind of a universe if things just randomly happen, and you'll find again that naturalism wins. Okay.
All right. Well, we heard a couple good retorts there. One, simultaneous causation is not possible. The bowling ball is not an actually simultaneous event. I would say in that state it is, but you'll remember that I explained the difference between something that is logically prior and something that is temporarily prior, and I explained what an efficient and a material cause is. And if it is difficult for something to happen without a material cause, then it has to be doubly difficult for it to happen without an efficient or a material cause. So this isn't an improvement for an atheistic position at all. In fact, I don't think that it undermines the argument from simultaneous causation with God causing the universe. Now, he says that it's a wrong question to ask whether where or how the universe popped into existence out of nothing. In fact, he says, quote, "There was nothing. How can something arise from nothing?" Great question. That's my point exactly. Something can't arise from nothing. The single most successful metaphysical principle of all time is out of nothing, nothing comes. So if out of nothing, nothing comes, we need an explanation for this, which is not nothing. How did it come into existence when there was nothing before it? And the answer, to me, is very clear. It is a timeless, spaceless, immaterial, enormously powerful, personal mind, all of which fit within the cosmological argument, which, again, has not gone contested tonight, except in its notion of how can it be causal in a temporal sense. Now, interestingly, Dennis has said in the past that he agrees with the cosmological argument from now for all time. Now, for the purpose of debate here, we will obviously go back and forth on that one, but ultimately, Dennis believes that the cosmological argument is valid. He just questions its results of timeless, spaceless, immaterial, personal, enormously powerful, etc. Correct?
No.
No. Okay. We've changed our opinion. That's good, too.
I'm a woman. I can change my opinion.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Objective morality does not exist. Now, he says evolution explains it. And remember what it is on evolution. It's an illusion. Our feeling that tearing a four-year-old girl limb from limb for fun is wrong is an illusion. It's not true. Now, I will tell you that, and I'm not the first to say it, and I wish I could quote the guy that did, that when someone tells you that is an illusion, that something like that is wrong, it's going to be based on more questionable premises than the fact itself. There is no way to affirm that tearing a four-year-old girl limb for limb is okay. And I don't think that Dennis believes that either. He says rape is not objectively moral. Now, he's consistent. That's correct. In atheism, there is no basis for objective morality. Rape is taboo. It's unfashionable, it might not be helpful evolutionarily, but it's not really wrong. But now you have to ask the question, do these moral rights and wrongs exist? If the Nazis had exterminated all the Jews in World War II, would it still be wrong to exterminate Jews, even if nobody was around to disbelieve that? And I think we would all say, of course it is. And I think Dennis would affirm that too. So I think that it is much more obvious that morals actually exist than it is that they might have arisen evolutionarily. So again, you have to decide whether you believe that's an illusion or not. Now, fine-tuning, he says that the universe is 99.999% not finely tuned for life. This is simply a misunderstanding of fine-tuning. The fine-tuning of the universe talks about the initial conditions for which the type of universe that we have can arise. If you're going to have a universe that can have things like carbon atoms and silicon and oxygen and nitrogen, even protons, neutrons, and electrons, you have to have the amount of space that we had in order to generate that from something small that gets stretched out. And again, this is Dennis's opinion that it's not a problem. The list of physicists, including ones who are hostile to Christianity, like Sean Carroll, agree that fine-tuning is a real thing. Roger Penrose, Stephen Hawking, just a couple names who believe and have written on the fine-tuning of the universe. So all respect to Dennis, but I'm going to take Roger Penrose's opinion on whether fine-tuning is real over his. He says, if there is no God, life is not special. If there is a God, life is special, but life isn't special. I disagree. And I wonder if he would agree that life is not special if I tried to take his son's life, or I tried to take his life. I think we all know life is special, but I think he's right. If there is no God, then life is not special. Do you think life is special? If so, you've got a basis for that on theism. And then he says, let's compare the predictions of theism versus naturalism, or metaphysical supernaturalism versus metaphysical naturalism, and see which one makes the most sense. Well, let's see. Which one asks us to believe in an illusion, that the origin of the universe is an illusion, the fine-tuning of the universe is an illusion, the fact that there are morals at all is an illusion, and what has gone unaddressed tonight, the fact that you can think or have free will. All of these are illusions. That's what the atheist side is asking you to believe. The theist side says that you can trust your intuitions, your rationality, and your scientific data.
First, I'd like to remind you that I never used the word illusion. I never said any of this was an illusion. And as far as quoting Sean Carroll, Scott is absolutely incorrect when he says that Sean Carroll agrees with fine-tuning. I can show you the quote right out of what I've got here as to what Sean Carroll thinks of fine-tuning for life. If the universe was finely tuned for... he likes to say that is a metaphysical first principle that out of nothing comes nothing. Well, if that's true, then how did God make it? If out of nothing comes nothing, how did God do it? Science has no idea, and it's perfectly fine to say that you don't know. There's a lot of things science doesn't know. But to say that out of nothing comes nothing applies only to science and not to God just doesn't make sense. I never said that tearing a four-year-old girl apart limb from limb not being wrong is an illusion. I never used that word. Of course we think it's wrong, but we think it's wrong because we are programmed to feel that way, not because it's objectively written on the cosmos somewhere. If objective morals exist, they would exist in any universe that's created by God. And if it's objectively moral, if this was a universe made of nothing but rocks, what good are objective morals? Where are they written on the cosmos? I maintain that so-called morality, codes of behavior, exist only because we are social animals. And we are evolved to do the things that we have to do to prolong the species and reproduce. To take an example, I don't know what are lions social animals? Or there must be some animals out there that are not social. They'll go tearing and raping and pillaging and doing whatever they want because it's not necessary for them to act in a way that is social. I also didn't say anything about evil. Does evil exist? Yeah, it's a word. But what's evil? I think it's just something that we give a name to for things that we just shouldn't be doing because, again, they're just not evolutionarily good, that they're not written on the cosmos somewhere. Okay, that's it.
All right, a lot of data's gotten thrown out tonight. Let's back up and have a look at it and see what we have. Now, I asked you at the beginning, if you're thinking of it, if you're taking notes, to write arguments for God's existence on one side, arguments against God's existence on the other side. Now, we've heard four arguments for God's existence, and we added the ontological argument as a fifth. And even, let's say, for argument's sake, that the cosmological argument is not valid, and let's say the ontological argument is unconvincing. We still have three arguments for the existence of God that are much easier, better explanations of things that we see, like morality, like fine-tuning, and like intentional states, free will. These have gone unanswered tonight and still make a good, strong, cumulative case that God exists. Now, have we heard any arguments that God does not exist? There have been no arguments tonight that God does not exist. There was an attempt at one, sort of, that said God is an incoherent concept, but it was never shown for us. No argument was advanced as to how God is incoherent. So at a minimum tonight, we have good logical and scientific evidence that leads us to the conclusion that God does exist. Now, Dennis has also said, if out of nothing, nothing comes, then how does God do it? He's missing the point. The theist doesn't say out of nothing, nothing comes. The theist says there's a timeless, spaceless, immaterial, enormously powerful personal mind out of which these things come. And if you don't think that things can come out of your mind, what about thoughts that you have on your own? It is entirely plausible for things to come out of a mind, certainly more so than they would come out of absolutely nothing. Now, we are programmed, Dennis says that we are programmed to think that things like tearing a four-year-old girl limb from limb are wrong. He says he didn't use the word illusion. But if he is saying that we're programmed to think that something is wrong, but in fact, in reality, it's not actually objectively wrong, what do you call that? That is an illusion. It's an illusion that it is wrong. So even if he's not using the word, the point that is being made by not just Dennis, but by all atheists, is that all of these things are not what they seem. Now, I would tell you that if the origin of the universe from apparently nothing, the fine-tuning of the universe, again, even if you want to drop Sean Carroll, take Roger Penrose as an example and a list of 50 other physicists that write extensively on the fine-tuning of the universe. If morality isn't real but is an illusion, if the fact that you can think at all, the fact that you think that you have free will, all of these are illusions. I will tell you that if we as humans, everywhere we look, from the origin of the universe to inside our own mind, if the only thing that we encounter is illusions, we should at least consider the possibility that there's a very powerful magician standing behind it all, because that's an awful lot of illusions. In fact, every single argument I've advanced, the opposite view is that the science that we see or the intuitions and logic that we use are illusory. Now, you have to decide whether you think that your rational faculties are that completely undependable. And there's one other thing that I would add to that. If it's an illusion that we think causation is real, if it's an illusion when we look at morality, we think that it is real, if it's an illusion when we look at intentionality, the fact that we can think about anything, if it's an illusion that we have free will, what possible grounds do we have for believing the apparent evidence that evolution is true? Why is that the only thing that is not an illusion? Why is materialism the only non-illusion in everything at which we look? Now remember, I'm not making an argument from faith. I'm making an argument from science and reason. These are opinions. If someone is asking you to look at the science and tell yourself it is an illusion, like Richard Dawkins says, it only appears designed, it's not designed. Or like Francis Crick says, you have to remind yourself that it's not designed. I think that these are not illusions, that your rational faculties are much more trustworthy than that. And if you don't have trust in those rational faculties, you cannot think anything as true or possible. If you cannot trust your rational faculties, then why can you trust your faculties about evolution? If you cannot trust your impressions, how can you trust your impressions about materialism. Dennis says, what happens in a universe of rocks? There are no morals. That's right, because the source of morality is God. When he gives a command to his contingent beings, that is in accordance with his nature and is either right or wrong. If there are no agents, God gives no commands. Not a problem. God is still by nature good, but there will be no evil at that point. Dennis asked the question, evil, does it even exist? Imagine that I shot Dennis's son.
Please.
Is that evil? If you're going to answer the question yes, that is actually evil, then that entails God exists. If you're willing to say, you know what, survival of the fittest, who cares? If that's how you feel, then you can rationally try to affirm that evolution is correct as well, from a materialistic perspective only. Now remember, I'm not arguing against evolution. I think that that's a possibility as well. But the question is, does God exist or does God not exist? That's our debate topic for tonight. So ultimately, in summary, I think we've seen 5 good arguments for God's existence, no arguments against God's existence. We've questioned 2 of the 5 arguments for God's existence, and I think that we have shown, at least passably, that those objections need not stand in our way of believing them. And what we've been offered as an alternative is only affirmations that these things that we see are illusory. So I will leave it up to you tonight to decide whether you're going to trust your own logic and you're going to trust our best scientific evidence, or if you're willing to pitch it all to the side and instead affirm, without any evidence or argument, that materialism is true, God does not exist. Thank you.
I wished I had counted the number of times Scott used the word illusion. Again, I remind you, I did not use that word. And I still stick by my statement that if out of nothing comes nothing, just making up some immaterial mind that can do it is not an answer. Again, I'm not here to prove that God doesn't exist. That's not why I'm up here. I'm here to show that there's no evidence that God exists. And I don't think Scott, or I think I have rebutted the evidence that Scott has presented that God exists. Now, if God really existed, there should be no reason, if God really existed, there's no reason why he should be so hard to find. He should be perfectly obvious, whereas in naturalism, you might expect people to believe in God, but the evidence to be thin on the ground. Under theism, you'd expect that religious beliefs would be universal. There's no reason for God to give special messages to this or that tribe thousands of years ago. Why not give it to anyone? Under naturalism, you'd expect different religious beliefs inconsistent with each other to grow up under different local conditions over time, and that's what's happened. Under theism, you'd expect religious doctrines to last a long time in a stable way. Under naturalism, you'd expect them to adapt to social conditions. And that's what has happened even to Christianity. Under theism, you'd expect the moral teachings of religion to be transcendent, progressive. Sexism is wrong. Slavery is wrong. Under naturalism, you'd expect they reflect, once again, local mores, sometimes good, sometimes bad. You'd expect the sacred texts under God to give us interesting information, tell us about the germ theory of disease, tell us to wash our hands before we have dinner. Under naturalism, you'd expect the sacred texts to be a mishmash, some really good parts, some poetic parts, some boring parts, and mythological parts, and that's exactly what we have. Under theism, you'd expect biological forms to be designed. Under naturalism, they would derive from the twists and turns of evolutionary history. Under theism, minds should be independent of bodies. Under naturalism, your personality should change if you're injured, tired, or you haven't had your cup of coffee yet. Under theism, you'd expect that maybe you can explain the problem of evil. God wants us to have free will. But there shouldn't be random suffering in the universe. Life should be essentially just. At the end of the day, with theism, you'd basically expect the universe to be perfect. Under naturalism, it should be some kind of a mess, and that's exactly what we have. Immanuel Kant, however you say it, once said, "There will never be an Isaac Newton for a blade of grass." In other words, you can find some physical explanation for the motion of the planets, but never for something as exquisitely organized and complex as a biological organism. Except, of course, that Charles Darwin went and did exactly that. I can paraphrase Scott's message as saying there will never be an Isaac Newton for the cosmos, but everything we know about the history of science and the current state of physics says we should be much more optimistic than that. Thank you. How many people drew a line down the paper and checked on each side? I didn't think so.
Now, I would like to do one thing really quickly. I know this is not normal, but the amount of courage it takes to be an atheist and to walk into a church and to have a debate in front of a group that's probably, 95% theists in here? That's guts.
At least 51%.
At least 51%. Round of applause for Dennis for sheer courage.
What we'd like to do now, we've got about another 20 minutes here, is we finished kind of ahead of time, which is great because we've got more time for Q&A now. I would like to open it up for questions and have you guys kind of form a line if you'd like to make a question up here on the left-hand side and come up. And what we're looking for are questions. And sometimes in a format like this, people kind of want to come up and give a statement. Sometimes they like to give a thesis. We would like for you to give a question. That would be fantastic. And one question per person. We'll get in as many as we can, and we'll allow 2 to 3 minutes for each person to respond, or as much time as they need within reason, without running the clock out, and then allow the other person to give a response as well. So if you would like to pose a question to either of these guys.
Maybe I can ask them in place, and we'll repeat them into the mics, because they don't have mics.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's going to have – either way. So anybody have questions? Please, by all means. You can come on up and say it into the mic, and then these guys can respond.
You can if it's Bruce. Yeah, if you want, we'll repeat it in the mic, and that way we'll have it. But go ahead.
I can say I really appreciate what you guys have done tonight, because this was nerve-wracking just to stand up and ask a question. So my question's for Dennis. Dennis, thank you so much for your presentation. Thank you for coming. Thank you for your time on Sundays as well. So I appreciate that you spent a couple minutes on yourself and your family. And I'm sorry to hear the scary situation your family went through way back when. But as you went through your talk, it raised a good question in my mind. If we live in a materialistic world where materialism's it, and the complaint that you gave was, well, 4 lives were saved, but 5 lives were lost. How does a materialistic world give those 5 lives any value? And why does it care?
I didn't quite get the last part of the question.
The question was, if we live in a materialistic world, then the lives that were spared, in the case of Dennis's house where the aircraft crash happened, why do they have value? And why did the people whose lives were lost, why do they have value if this world is solely materialistic?
That's a good question. I'm not the one who came up with the idea of miracles. That's your guy's invention. I just say that because a life is saved doesn't necessarily mean it's a miracle. It just happens. Those 4 people in the plane were in the wrong place at the wrong time. My wife and kids and I and the one dog, we were in the right place at the right time under those circumstances. There's no rhyme or reason to it. It just is. I don't know if that answers your question. That's the best I can do.
Was the question more about miracles or about value?
It was more about how does a materialistic world, complain in any way over the loss of those lives. It shouldn't have mattered.
Oh, I see. Well, to my way of thinking, there is no value to life. There's no purpose in us being here. We're here. This is not a rehearsal. This is just, we're here, and there's no special value to any of us.
Scott, do you want to address
it? Yeah, I think ultimately, obviously I disagree. I think life is valuable. I think we know that intuitively. I think we demonstrate that with our own actions. And I like drawing a distinction between an intellectual point and a belief point. So it's easy to say something like, well, intellectually, I don't believe life has value. And why is that? Well, it's because I believe we're evolutionarily derived from a materialistic universe. So there is no basis for me to think that life is valuable.
But Dennis steers left when there's somebody in the crosswalk and doesn't hit them. In fact, I know Dennis as a friend pretty well, and he does some amazingly kind, nice things. I won't tell the whole story, but he's gone way out of his way to befriend a homeless gentleman who is in the most dire straits that many of us would probably walk away from him, and Dennis doesn't. So I will tell you, while Dennis will tell you that he thinks life isn't valuable, he sure acts like he thinks life is valuable, and I think that's because we all know life is valuable, really.
Dennis, thank you also for coming. I had a discussion with an atheist at one point, and he made a comment that he and his family went to Yosemite National Park, and they literally sat in silence for 2 hours staring at the beauty that they saw before them. I've never been there myself. I'd love to see it someday. But the question I came back to him, and I don't remember his answer. I don't know that he gave me an answer. Where did that sense of beauty come in? That even that he would recognize that as something beautiful. Why isn't it that we sit at overlooking a city dump and think, boy, this is just beautiful? I mentioned this to him, that 99% of everybody in the entire world would sit at Yosemite National Park and would agree that is a beautiful thing to look at. They would not say the same thing about a city dump. Where did that sense of beauty come from your point of view? Why would people agree that Yosemite National Park is beautiful?
Well, we are aesthetic beings. We recognize what we think is beauty. Why would somebody sit in front of a piece of abstract art and call it beauty and art? And I would look at it and say, are you kidding? Getting back to your question about, and Scott's comment, that life isn't valuable. Of course, my life is valuable to me. My life is not valuable to somebody in Taiwan. I'm just saying that life in general, evolutionarily speaking, is not of any value as a intellectual concept. Are you thinking that an atheist cannot sit in Yosemite and look at it and find it beautiful?
No, what I'm asking is, why would 99% of the entire population of the world say that site is beautiful? Where did that common sense of beauty come from?
I have no idea.
Yeah, obviously, briefly, the theist has a grounds for that. Maybe if I was arguing the atheistic side, I could say common descent, common derivation of mind, brain at least, would lead us to draw some of the same conclusions as a population. But maybe even that's why we have some differing theories of what's beautiful. To some people, pierced noses and painted faces is more beautiful. To some people, mascara and rouge is more beautiful. So I think you can explain it from both sides, but ultimately, the point I would make on that one is your wet matter in the bone in your head is thinking about beauty and Yosemite. This is an impossibility on materialism. You have to have some sort of dualism to explain why you can even be thinking about Yosemite. So I still see it as a proof of God, if maybe a little more biologically so and philosophically.
Okay. Hi, Scott. So I think Dennis at least alluded to the fact that God was a maximally great being, like the highest conceivable being. And he somewhat made the point, but he got lost as the rebels came in, that you can always conceive of a maximally great being, and somebody can conceive of a higher being, and a greater being, and a greater being, so on and so forth. And you argued against infinity. So it seems like a maximally great being just continuously is, you can conceive of an infinitely greater being, therefore just conceiving of such being is incoherent. Like, why would you say that if you don't like infinities?
So this is the ontological argument. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I would say if when you first try to think of a maximally great being, you think of something less than maximally great, so you conceive of another being who's greater, this being that you conceived of wasn't maximally great. This was quasi-maximally great or nearly maximally great. So when you finally get done thinking to whatever you get to as the most maximally great being, that's your maximally great being. Now, is it possible for a human being with 10 to the something connections of neurons in their brain to conceive of a maximally great being completely and understand it completely, I'd say no, there's too much of a limitation on there. But it doesn't mean that a maximally great being can't ontologically exist. I would say maybe a way to think of it is this. What you're saying is if you come up with a container that is a gallon, well, you can conceive of a container that's a gallon and a half. Well, a maximally great being is, or a maximally full container
at a gallon is a gallon's worth of volume. A maximally full container at 2 gallons is 2 gallons worth of volume. So it depends on the world that you're trying to imagine. So in a world like ours, a maximally great being would be things like all good, all loving, omniscient, omnipresent, omnibenevolent, those types of things. And that is the concept of God in this world. So the attribution of the impossibility of a maximally great being to the paucity of human imagination isn't a good argument against the ontological argument, in my opinion, and really does nothing to reduce that third premise, which is the basis of the ontological argument, nor does it make God impossible. The question is it possible there is a maximally great being? I think it's easy for us to imagine at least the concept of there is a being that maximally instantiates excellence in all areas. So to me, and maybe to Reuben's point as well, the ontological argument doesn't convince a lot of people. And it's just because it's a difficult argument to get your head around. And I think a philosopher once said, when you're a young philosopher, it is so obvious the ontological argument is wrong, but you can't figure out where. And by the time you become an old philosopher, it's very clear that the ontological argument is valid, but you can't figure out why. So that's why I don't lead with the ontological argument, as it's convincing to me, but it's not convincing to most.
If God exists, he's not just the God of this world. He is the maximally greatest being that can exist anywhere. So just confining him to the maximally greatest being that we can imagine is not the answer. If there is a maximally great being, and that is as high as you can go, although I don't see how, because you can always go one more than infinity, but let's assume that there is a maximum, there must be an infinite number of less maximally great beings below that. Where are they?
I would love to talk infinities and actual infinities, but I don't want to bore everybody tonight. I can go on forever about those. But ultimately, remember that we are not the possible worlds. Ontologies are constructed on.
You got your say.
You can go back to. Possible worlds are not saying that these worlds actually exist. When a philosopher talks about a possible world, what he means is a possible configuration of the actual world. It's just a way that this one world that we observe could possibly be. So that's a common misunderstanding, but again, a reason why I don't usually talk ontological argument.
This would be a deeply philosophical argument. As you
well, I get my
tell.
Say now.
Yes, sir.
I saw some hands.
Wait a minute. I get my say. I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember Saturday Night Live back in the day, but there was a character in there who got an explanation like that, would say, how convenient.
You interrupted me for that?
Go ahead back there.
You mentioned earlier that the idea of simultaneous causation was a reason to not believe in God. Why is that the case if there's a maximally supreme being who could decide when and where to become temporal in the world or universe that he created?
How can he decide when to become temporal if he's in a place where there is no time?
Simultaneously.
Simultaneously. And that was your question. If God exists before time and space, how does he go through the process of deciding, oh yeah, now I'm going to get into time? That requires time, doesn't it?
I'm not sure.
So to answer Dennis's question, I think what we're talking about is a transition from a God from God as he exists. What the Christian orthodoxy would say is he exists eternally. And in specifying what we mean by that, we would say he exists timelessly. So Dennis is saying, well, he's got to make the decision to do it and then do it. Well, I don't think that's the case. I think logically prior to his creation of the universe, he was timeless. But simultaneous is his decision to create, his command to create, and the existence and the universe beginning to exist. In fact, the moment T equals zero is that same moment when God says, let it be, fiat lux, or let the universe come into existence. Actually, I guess that was let there be light. But ultimately, I don't see a reason to say causation can't be simultaneous when going from a changeless state of an eternal God to a now temporal God. And I guess I don't want to get into it to steal too much time, but the actual opinion that I hold
is different from Craig's. I don't believe that God was atemporal without creation, and that we are now, he is timeless, that he is temporal with creation. In fact, I actually take Dennis's position on this, at least half of it, which is this, for a maximally great being to lose an essential trait would be to indicate that he wasn't maximally great. So if being eternal and changeless is an essential trait, the maximally great being can't lose that. I think science, and remember, God's existing eternally, so it's not like there's this infinite regress of time. He's existing in this eternal, changeless state. I think of that as that's my concept of the Father. And then when we see in the Bible where it says, through Christ and in Christ were all things created, and we look at the great creeds where we say the Son is begotten eternally of the Father, I think that the begetting of the Son and the creation of the universe happen in logical chain. The Father begets the Son, who then creates the universe as its creator, Lord, and master. And the Son is temporal. And the Son exists in time. And the Father exists timelessly, and from, depending on which creed, from the Father and the Son proceeds the Spirit. And so the explanation of why the Trinity exists is that God was going to and did create a reality. And that the reason that you see a Trinity is because there is a spiritual side to this reality, an immaterial side, and a material side to this reality, which gives you three consciousnesses of God, and a reason for there to be three consciousnesses of God. That is to say, if God is a maximally great being, then I agree with Dennis, his traits should be essentially true. And if his traits are essentially, if he is essentially Trinitarian, then he must be Trinitarian necessarily. And if he's Trinitarian necessarily, in my opinion, the best explanation is that is contingent on the fact that he did simultaneously create the universe. But that's not exactly considered Christian orthodoxy today.
Yeah, that's...
Do you want to mention RBC? I
don't think not RBC's opinion. we have an elder in the back who can vouch. So this is an experimental line of thinking that I'm working down right now. That just happens to be mine, but I just... Mostly to see Dennis's jaw drop, said I agree with Dennis on that... On that side.
There was another question. Let's do two more questions. There's one back here with your hand up, and then we'll come to the right.
I've actually been studying quantum physics for the past 11 years. It's kind of hard to articulate the question, but first of all, I want to make a statement that time is not an object. Time is a measurement of the movement of space. That's why they call it space-time. In that case, you can have simultaneous causality with extreme time dilation, where you have one action, the other action, time dilation in the middle, both happening at exactly the same time. And you interpret that also with the holographic universe theory, where you have non-locality, where everything's in one place, but also in multiple places at once. How does that tie into your argument?
Mine?
Both.
Are you positing that that after time exists, there is this dilation of time?
I guess the best way to explain it is, let's say, for example, you take the Big Bang, explosion, expansion, however you want to look at it. The idea that time exists means that space is moving. Therefore, if space is not moving, time also doesn't exist. So anything outside of movement is not in existence as we would interpret existence. In that point, if you had a Big Bang, for example, and a big expansion, and you put it in a layer kind of setting, things are moving faster on the outside than on the inside, which means you have things moving close to the speed of light with extreme time dilation, meaning you could look and appear as though it's billions of years old when it's actually only a few days old and still in the middle of a process of expansion.
Okay, but this is all after time begins to exist.
A God in the holographic universe, the ability to use, these are different words, I'm pretty sure you aren't exactly familiar with, but you have a quantum potential. And if you take a hologram, you have a quantum potential where everything is all in the same spot, same time, everything's all at one point. But then also is projected into what we see as existence. In that point, a God, it being outside of that existence, can manipulate both that point and everything outside of it. Therefore, he can both be inside of time and outside of time at the same time.
If you say so.
So I'll try to keep this brief, but this is an area of thought that I love too.
Can you restate the question a little bit?
Yeah, maybe. I think there are about... there were, in reality, probably three or four questions in there. One is, what's the reality and nature of time? Does it exist, or is it a... is it a convention or a way of thinking of things, or is it an ontic reality?
Time's
secondly,
up.
If yeah, if quantum states exist, they really progress from one state to another. They don't necessarily move continuously from one to another. The question of can time be considered quantized if we're going to consider space quantized? And can you, whether you think of it as a superpositional way of looking at it or a hologram way of looking at it, can two things be happening from that same point, set of points, space, De Sitter space, et cetera. And I think I will admit to being both appreciative and critical of quantum dynamics. I think it's a very valuable calculational tool, and I think a lot of people forget that that's what it was. It's a calculation tool. We looked at subatomic particles of a certain type, and we said we can't both know their position and their momentum at the same time, so there's uncertainty. Because there's uncertainty, we're going to calculate things a certain way. And basically, we're going to come up with things like qubits, and say, even though there may be 180 degrees of spin in this one direction, we're only going to talk about them in one direction. That is an artificiality. And like time, I agree with the person asking the question. I don't think time exists. Because when you say, what is time?
It's an illusion.
It is, in fact, the way that our mind conceives of reality, where it is motion. So when we design, when you say, what is a year? Well, what we really mean is it's the motion of the universe, motion of the Earth around the sun one time. If you say, now we've defined a second by a number of vibrations or cycles of a cesium-123 atom in atomic clocks, that definition is still on motion. So if we're talking about motion and time and we can't divorce the two, I want to invoke Leibniz's identity of indiscernible or indiscernible of identicals and say if someone threw the switch on this room and stopped time and made a bunch of observations, then they threw their magic switch again, and they stopped motion in the room and made their observations, that those would be identical. There'd be no difference at all. And to me, this says that time and motion are identical. So whether you think of it in a quantum paradigm or whether you think of it, in my opinion, I still think you can do so continuously in a finite, trivial topology of a limited universe. You can still do so, use Schrodinger's wave functions, use wave functions to describe reality, and not have to do so with a dt in there. It's a useful calculational tool, but it's not a real thing.
I'll give a cookie to anybody who understood any of that.
Some of these arguments go very deep. This is a basic argument, actually, that at least it begins basic. It's called the cosmological argument. It has two premises and a conclusion. Number one, everything that begins to exist has a cause. Number two, the universe began to exist. And then the conclusion is, therefore, the universe has a cause. That's what Scott was arguing. Dennis agrees with the first two premises, I believe.
No?
Okay, well, it does not. So Dennis is on a different side on that argument, but you can obviously go very deep with that. There's a gentleman over here behind Brian that had his hand up for asking a question.
I'd like to ask you clarify your belief in objective morality, because it sounded to me as though you said we know it exists because we all believe in it, and we all believe in it because it exists. So, like, what is the... why does it exist?
Right, why does it exist? So that's a good question. Sorry. Yeah, to restate the question, it sounds like the questioner was saying, it sounds like I was making a circular definition that we know that morality exists. How do we know that it exists? Well, we just sense it. Why do we sense it? Because morality exists objectively. So that would be a circular argument. So I'm not saying that that is the justification for it. I'm saying we should consider the fact that we observe behaviors, things in this universe, in this world, as being morally, objectively wrong. That's evidence. Now the question is, what's the argument against which that evidence can be applied? And I would use that evidence to support the second premise of the logical argument of, if God does not exist, then objective moral values do not exist. However, objective moral values do exist. Now, I'm supporting the second premise in the argument, objective moral values do exist, by saying when I observe a four-year-old, thank goodness I haven't seen this, if I observe a four-year-old girl being torn apart, I say to myself, that is wrong. Now the question is it objectively wrong? How do I decide whether it's objective or not? The question is, would that be wrong even if there was nobody in the world that believed it? Now, we do have to appeal, and I think the questioner's opinion, point here is good in one sense. That is an intuitive belief, the belief that, by intuition, that this is wrong. Is it possible our intuition is mistaken there? Of course, it is possible. The question is it more plausibly true? Is it more plausible, is it more likely that it's wrong or that it's an illusion? And that's what I'm asking you to consider. You're right. It's not an ironclad argument that says because it feels wrong, it is wrong. But what we're saying is it is more plausibly true that this is actually wrong than this is just a set of illusions that we happen to be wrong about. So a good point, and I'm glad that you brought it up because a lot of people will say things like, I can prove objective morality exists. Look at what happens if you torture a four-year-old girl. That is evidence. You need an argument. And so that's the argument I would offer to you.
Scott earlier used the example of rape as something that's objectively wrong. And I posited that way back in the day of early man, rape was not objectively wrong, that it was not viewed to be wrong. It was viewed to be the way things are. So I think the idea of what's wrong and what's right and what's moral, what's immoral, changes over time, and that none of it is objective.
And I, if I wasn't clear on my definition of objective, by objective I mean something that is actually wrong whether people believe it or not. So in my definition, objective cannot change. It is a permanent thing. It is an ontic reality. So if I didn't make that clear, apologize.
Can we do one more question?
Okay. I'm clearly not the smartest person in this room. I'm okay. So let me ask you a more basic question. If the premise of tonight's discussion was, does God exist? Is that an intellectual question? Is it an academic question? Is it an eternal question? Let me ask you the so what question. Does the answer to that question matter? Or is this just an intellectual conversation? And what I'd like, the way I'd like to pose this is, Scott, I'd like you to tell me in a second or two.
Good luck with that. That's the hardest request you made tonight.
What if Dennis is right? And Dennis, I'd like to challenge you. What difference does it make? What if Scott's right?
Go ahead, Scott.
So two questions are made. It sounded like two questions to me. One was, we'll just answer the one that he asked directly. What if Dennis is right of me? If it is the case that Dennis is right, I do want to know that for a couple of reasons. One, I'm holding back a lot in being a Christian. There's a lot of potential that I could realize. I really get Machiavellian. You know, I'm not a good person deep down. And what I would do is, if that was the case, I would give way to some of my more base instincts. And I would be leading some empire somewhere if I could. So it would I would stop being a servant. I wouldn't see the point of love as it is. I would, in fact, probably get a little tyrannical because if there's no objective morality, just making myself happy is the only thing I care about. And I care about more about me being happy than I do about you being happy. Now, that means you're in my way and you bleed as a result. Tough life. But I can't bring myself to do that. And I haven't gotten that close. I'm not that sociopathic that I've really seriously weighed that. But when I consider other things in my life, I find it difficult to imagine that is the case. So I am compelled to believe in morality. And as a result, I bend my will towards that source of that morality. Otherwise, it'd get ugly quickly.
I do not think it's an academic question or just a silly question. I truly think the belief in God is bad. And the reason I think that is that it, for a lot, probably not Scott and probably not the man in the back of the room who's studying quantum dynamics, but belief in God quashes a lot of curiosity. A lot of religious people, a lot of people who believe in God, the Buddha, Hindu, whatever God, they just say, well, I've got the answer. And look no further. And to me, that is bad for the human species, that it stops being curious about things. I am particularly ticked off about people using God and religion and the church to try to get creation, to try to get evolution out of the schools and creationism taught in the schools. No offense, Dan. I think that's silly. So to me, it's a very real question. I also have a problem with a lot of evangelical Christians who get in my face and tell me I'm going to hell. It's the arrogance of some beliefs in God that just drive me up the wall. So I think it's a very real question, not just an academic one.
Yeah, I agree. Now, with your permission, a quick rejoinder. I disagree with Dennis's opinion and that religion quashes scientific inquiry or thought. Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, Newton, Boyle, the majority of the greats in physics and chemistry and natural sciences were Christians. After 100 years of Nobel Prizes, I'm now reading off the internet a little bit here, 65.4% of Nobel Prize laureates identified Christianity in its various forms as their religious preference. Christians have won a total of 78.3% of Nobel Prizes in peace, 72% in chemistry, 65% in physics, 62% in medicine, 54% in economics, and 49% in literature. And you'll notice that the more room there is for fiction, the less Christianity there is.
If I may add, Yasser Arafat also won the Peace Prize.
Fair point.
Einstein. A lot of modern-day scientists are anything but believers in God. Back in the day of Copernicus, that's all there was. That's all they knew. Now we know a lot more.
Let's give these guys one final round of applause.